number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Right. It is Friday the 23rd of February in the glorious future year of 2024. And I'm getting a somewhat slow start to the day. But yes, of course, February, and even in leap year, has only 29 days, so this is the last Friday of the month. Very early last Friday of the month. See you, JKH, asking if I'm still doing Twitch. I've moved that to PeerTube because, frankly, Twitch with its, you know, various monetization features and all, you know, just kept sending me emails saying, you only need to get 99 more followers before we'll consider, you know, giving you a penny every now and then. It's like, So I decided to move to TubeNix, which is SDF's PeerTube instance, once that began supporting live streaming, because firstly, I appreciate the non-commercial aspect of it from an abstract sense, but secondly, it's just that much less annoying. I don't have an easy way to switch to something resembling music on hold is the problem, because I need to duck out for a minute. Sorry about that. And one thing that I'm live, you know, I'm sending this out using FFmpeg, and FFmpeg, for all its power and flexibility, doesn't really support on-the-fly input switching. Figure out something to do about that. Of course, I suppose I could just, you know, play something over my stereo system and let it get picked up by the microphone. Clumsy, but potentially workable. There's the kettle. Okay, now I have a cup of tea, which is important. For anyone who's interested, by the way, I want to let you know that Uriel passes and Interrail passes are on sale, 15% off, until, I think the sale for Interrail passes ends on March 5th, and the sale for Uriel passes ends on March 12th. For those of you who may not be familiar, the Eurail Pass is a thing you buy if you're outside Europe and you want to travel around in Europe. You can buy various more or less unlimited railway tickets, essentially, which allow you to just hop on whatever service you want and take it anywhere. The Interrail is the equivalent for people who live in Europe. In this case, Europe, including Britain, which is... Apparently, this is the one thing that Brexit didn't ruin, was the Eurail Pass. It's also valid on some ferries, and from what I can find out, even the ferries it's not valid on, there's a, that you can't just hop on, there's a discount. All right, so back to the Umberto Nobile book, My Polar Flights. And we were reading last time, we got as far as the list of the Italian crew members of the polar flight, the polar crossing flight of the N1 Norge. Yes. Natale Ceccioni, 39, a Florentine, a very resourceful man who could turn his hand to anything. He had 20 years' experience in the workshops and 15 as an engine mechanic in flight. When I sent for him to ask if he would like to come with me, he said, simply and unhesitatingly, yes, nor did he ever have a moment's doubt subsequently, even when, as he told me afterwards, his friends tried to dissuade him. During the whole journey, he was tireless. Sometimes he grumbled. Often he made rude remarks in his Florentine dialect, but always he was at his post, whether on the ground or on board. One of Ceccioni's characteristics was not to trouble in the least whether the person he was talking to understood his dialect. Whilst he worked, I heard him talking in Tuscan to English workmen, Russian soldiers, and even to the Eskimos. The best of it was that they really did understand him, since the work got done without any difficulty. He was tall, solidly built, weighed 15 stone and a half. It was not surprising, therefore, if during the polar flight he was continually grousing that he had not enough to eat. "We're dying of hunger here!" How many times during those 3 days in the air did that phrase not ring in my ears? Ettore Arduino from Verona. Yes, that's Arduino. First-grade engine mechanic, with a dozen years flying experience, decorated for military valor, serious, taciturn. He was my reserve chief engineer. If Ceccioni needed rest, or had fallen ill and been left behind during the journey, Arduino would have taken his place. Always calm and serene, he went quietly about his tasks. I never heard him grumble, criticize, or complain. During the flight, he too was untiring. Attilio Carati, 30, from Brescia, an experienced airship mechanic, the only one who went off without leaving a wife and family behind him. I sent Carati up for a medical examination, the same as the others, but the report was unfavorable. He was quite healthy, but there was a history of trouble. The previous year he had suffered from acute rheumatism in his joints, which might have suddenly attacked him during a long flight in a very severe climate. I called him into my office and told him that on medical advice, in his own interests and those of the expedition, I was obliged to do without him. Carati, standing rigidly to attention, did not blanch, but his eyes reddened and shone with tears. I made up my mind. Against the doctor's advice, Carati joined the expedition. Vincenzo Pomella, a southerner, with blue eyes and thick fair hair, he had been working for many years in my workshops, a first-rate motor mechanic. No need to expatiate on how he behaved during the flight. His pluck and physical endurance were unequaled. It suffices to say that during our crossing of the Arctic Ocean, the stern engine under his control worked uninterruptedly, regularly, and for 71 hours on end. Renato Alessandrini, a Roman, a rigger. I had known him for years. For years he had worked in the assembling of our airships. He climbed around everywhere, like a squirrel, worked for hours and hours in impossible positions, in places which anyone else would have found inaccessible. His intelligence was as lively and supple as his limbs. He knew our ship inside out, having worked for months to put it together. Like all the others, he had made dozens of flights in our dirigibles. When I first decided to lead the venture, Alessandrini was one of those whom I intended to take with me. Even if he had refused, I would have metaphorically forced him to come, but there was no need, for when I asked him, he at once said yes, and as I insisted on telling him to consider well the risks he would be running, and began to explain them to him, he broke in, "No need of all that! You are going, so I'm coming too." But a few days before we left, Alessandrini fell seriously ill with double pneumonia, so that the Norge left Rome without him. I had resigned myself to losing him. But one day, after our arrival in Russia, I saw him enter the hangar at Gatchina, cheerful and smiling as usual. From Leningrad to Teller, Alessandrini did not leave his post on board. He stayed beside me in the cabin and often took over the rudder. From time to time I sent him into the interior of the ship to inspect it and see that all was in order, or to help Ciccioni. With his good-humored, rosy face, he brought a note of gaiety to both the polar expeditions in which he took part. These were the five Italians who made the first crossing of the Arctic Ocean with me, and with me flew twice over the North Pole. To find out exactly how much of the useful load could be taken up by petrol, we had to know the weight of each member of the crew. I had them weighed in their ordinary clothes, without their furs or overcoats, and this was the result. And the table is given in kilograms and then approximate equivalent stone, which I think I shall omit because it is not a very interesting unit, you know, to me. Alessandrini, 67 kilograms, marked down here as equivalent to 10 stone. Arduino, 82 kilograms. My goodness. Karate 72, Cecchioni 97, Gottwald 89, Horgan 82, Malmgren 69, Nobile 60. He was a little bitty guy, really. 9.5 stone. Olomkin 85, Almdahl 73, Pomela 59, Rieser Larsen 99, Visting 76, and finally the journalist Ram at 91 kilograms. Note, 14.5 stone. Thrig says that's heavy for an Arduino, right? 13-stone Arduino is probably the name of a punk album. Some kind of, or Electro Fuzz, or 8-bit or something. The King at Ciampino. Now that the work was finished, on February 27th, with a flight over Naples, I started a series of tests that were to last all through March. King Victor Emmanuel intended to take part in one of these flights, but on the day that had been arranged, weather conditions were so bad that I had to limit myself to making one or two low-altitude circuits of the field. I was on quite friendly terms with the King. For years past, he had been interested in the construction of our dirigibles, and had always seemed to be pleased when I invited him to visit our works and fly in the airships I had built. One of his latest flights had been on the Roma, before it was handed over to the American Navy. On that occasion, I had admired his calm when, by an error in pilotage, the ship tilted at a dangerous angle. The King, who was chatting as he looked out of a porthole, gave no sign that he had noticed anything wrong, although he had to cling onto the parapet to keep his balance, and quietly went on with the conversation. He was very simple in his manners, and so was not surprised when I received him without any ceremony. In fact, judging from the way he looked at me, I think he liked it. Once the polar expedition had been decided upon, he wanted to know all about it. He had confidence in our airship, but he did not hide from me his anxiety about the meteorological conditions we might meet, more especially the risk that the ship might be weighed down by ice. I remembered his accurate observations a few weeks later when, right in the midst of the polar regions, I was surprised at the rapidity with which ice formed on the metal parts of the airship. Mussolini and the Expedition. Often in these last years I have asked myself whether the Norge expedition would have taken place even if Mussolini had not been in power. That is a question which is not easily answered. Even without Mussolini, the Aero Club of Norway might have bought and won from the Italian government. This was not the first dirigible that had been sold abroad. Others in previous years had been built by us for the American Army and Navy, the Spanish Navy, for the Argentine, England, and Japan. But yes, the one that went to Britain was, of course, the M1 that Captain Meagher piloted. The Roma was shipped to the United States in crates, re-erected there, inflated with hydrogen, and promptly flown into a power line where it caught fire and burned, thus leading to the U.S. policy of using only helium. I believe the one... I don't have complete information about the one that was built for the Argentines, but I have the impression that they canceled the sale and that this got Nobile in trouble with the Italian government. Yes, King Victor Emmanuel was a notable scholar. He was an author of a massive volume, multi-volume set, like 13 volumes on Italian coinage, a great numismatist, who completely reformed the Rome Mint and greatly increased the quality of its products. The one thing, unfortunately, he seems to have been is somewhat ineffectual as a monarch, with the result that, you know, Mussolini was able to take over and run things. You know, thus the danger with a constitutional monarchy is that if a monarch has a useful role in the modern world, I think it's probably to step in when the elective government is going too far. But the question is, how do you make that work? It's a very difficult problem. But it is very doubtful whether things would have gone as quickly as they did with Mussolini. When Air Ministry officials, who were airship experts, told him that it was impossible to reach the pole with a ship as small as N1, instead of being taken aback, he reacted in his own fashion, sending General Bonzani, the Assistant Secretary for Aviation, to tell me to hurry up the start. I saw Mussolini for the first time at the end of March 1926, when I took Dr. Thomason, president of the Aero Club of Norway, to see him at Palazzo Chigi. He was in excellent humor, affable, and cordial, as he was whenever I saw him subsequently. He asked questions about the preparations, fetched a map of the polar region, and indicated our proposed route. We discussed the various possibilities, and he said, "You will succeed. There is no doubt of that." In that quiet, sonorous voice that inspired confidence in those who listened to him. He asked what provisions we were taking. Pemmican, biscuits, chocolate, tea. Suddenly he remarked, "But then, it's not necessary to eat." He seemed convinced of that, and almost succeeded in convincing me, who would willingly have left food behind in order to take on more fuel. When we left, Mussolini said, "I shall come and say goodbye to you at Ciampino, and wish you good luck." But before that, I saw him on March 29th, the day when, at Ciampino, the dirigible was solemnly handed over to the expedition and christened the Norge. The Italian flag, which for 2 years had proudly flown from its stern, was hauled down and replaced by that of Norway. Mussolini gave it to me, saying, "This is to be dropped on the ice of the pole," and he ordered the officers who were standing by, "Prepare a fine casket to keep it in on board." Pardon me. He had said, "I will come to see you off," and kept his word. On April 3rd, everything was ready at Ciampino. Mussolini arrived. It was the day after the Gibson woman had tried to assassinate him. His wound, which was probably still painful, had not prevented him from coming. He was pale, and there was a bandage over his nose. He took up his position on the field to await the start, while I was busy with the preparations. But the weather, which since the early morning had been threatening, was rapidly getting worse. I was in a quandary. Though I did not want to jeopardize the success of the expedition right at the beginning by a maneuver which the high wind would have render extremely hazardous, it was rather embarrassing to have to tell the chief of government I shall have to put off our departure when he had arrived punctually in spite of his physical condition. Then I made up my mind and went to tell him, "The weather is too bad. I am putting off the start." "Good," he said. "You are quite right. If the weather is unfavorable, it is better not to take the risk. You will start when it clears up." He added that he would not be able to come back and see us off because he had to journey to Tripoli, and he embraced me as he said goodbye. "You will succeed. Everything will go well. I am sure of it. You will go and come back victorious." One good consequence, I suppose, of Mussolini's close personal friendship with Italo Balbo, the pioneer aviator, was that he understood that aircraft are weather sensitive. But that Argonne Labs audio documentary about Enrico Fermi that I played, you know, that it gives you the feeling there were a lot of people who may not have liked Mussolini's regime, but were found it not too difficult to put up with, I think. Found it not too difficult to put up with until 1937, when he really began to tie up with Hitler, at which point they said, hey, wait, you know, Mussolini was enhancing the international prestige of Italy to some extent, although, frankly, I'm not sure that invading Ethiopia was really such an enhancement. But now we're going to be playing second fiddle to this German. You know, and then, of course, the Italian fascists began doing things like passing copycats of Hitler's racial laws and that kind of thing. And, you know, again, Laura Fermi, her father, who was Jewish, was an admiral in the Italian Navy. You know, the Italian kingdom had been much more cosmopolitan, you know. And a lot of people began saying, hey, this, you know, we didn't like what was before, but it was, you know, we lived with it, but this is bad. I don't know, this is... It's kind of, you know, what do you do? I mean, you know, obviously, you have to be a real crank to be constantly plotting to overthrow the government of your country. You know, most people don't want to be that person. I don't know. You know, it's always difficult. See you, JKH, thinking of the way that the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, and then, of course, Napoleon, who made his son the King of Rome. Anyway. The load and the crew at the departure from Rome. Everything was in order a week before the Norgis started. The equipment in place, the reservoirs full, nothing was lacking except the personal luggage of the crew, and this was put aboard at the last moment. The interior of the airship looked distinctly picturesque. We had distributed an enormous quantity of materials in the various sections of the hull, using the girders to support them, but the little control cabin was equally cluttered. When the kit bags and suitcases of some of the crew were added, there was hardly room to move. Among the many things on board, I will mention as a curiosity two armchairs in steel tubing covered with velvet, intended for Amundsen and Ellsworth. Ratshu says, Emperor of Ethiopia. Oh, gosh. So I found an Italian newsreel. So archive.org has newsreels. It's a Hungarian newsreel from 1940 or so. Anyway, one of the items is the proclamation of Victor Emmanuel as King of Croatia. You know, the... Italian forces had, with the backing of the Germans, had dismembered Yugoslavia anyway, and Victor Emmanuel, in addition to having invaded Albania several years before, they'd now taken over Croatia, and so Victor Emmanuel was made nominal or titular King of Croatia as well as King of Albania. The reason why I found it interesting was that they had the... They had the train pulling in to Dubrovnik, possibly? I'm not 100% sure. But it was your standard overhead wire electrification. It's like, this is really a backwater in Europe, and yet it's electrified. No steam locomotive here. When my aunt was in the Peace Corps, she spent some time in East Africa. This was in the 70s, and she had, during one of her, you know, when they were moving her from one place to another, she was in Mogadishu for a few days, and she said they have really good Italian food. Somalia, which was put together from the colonies of British Somaliland and Italian Somaliland, which helps to explain, you know. Anyway. Yes. 21 of us left Rome, including Major G.H. Scott, the English airship expert, who had kindly put himself at our disposal to help prepare our landing at Pulham, and Lieutenant Mercier of the French Air Ministry, who had asked to fly with us over France in case we were forced to land there. Besides these two officers, who left us when we reached England, we had on board, as a passenger as far as Leningrad, the journalist Quattrini, whom I liked at once because he struck up a great friendship with my little dog Titina. But in Russia he had to make way for Cesco Tomaselli of the Corriere della Sera. Yes, Corriere della Sera, which is still one of the major Italian newspapers last time I checked. Morning Post, I suppose. The 21 people on board weighed altogether 3,600 pounds, but allowing for each another 33 pounds for fur coats, changes of underwear, toilet articles, and provisions to be eaten during the flight, I arrived at a figure of 4,294 pounds. Again, the confusion of units, as the translator insists on quoting us, pounds in one place and stones in another instead of the original kilograms. Besides the persons I have named, we had on board, right from the start in Rome, a 22nd who remained at her post all the way to Teller, someone who took up very little room and weighed practically nothing, Titina. 10 inches high and 12 pounds in weight. That was all. Titina thoroughly disliked flying, but she would not let me go alone, and she was always under my feet on board. Though she was still very young, she had several hundreds of flying hours to her credit when she took part in our expedition. My wife. Excavator goes by the window again. A journey to the pole was not something that was often undertaken in those days. As for flying there, no one had as yet done it at all, so it is not surprising that when I first mentioned it to my wife, she did not believe me. Then, when she realized that I was not joking, she raised a few objections, but she did not insist. She resigned herself. This is not to say that she had any illusions about the risks I was running. She knew them all, because I had told her myself, and so had my brothers who came to ask her to dissuade me from the undertaking. Her self-control was so great that she was able, without getting upset, to listen to the advice I gave her about bringing up our daughter in case I did not come back. But in the last days, when our parting was imminent, my wife began to show her distress. She could not sleep at night. Sometimes she could no longer restrain herself and said, "I won't let you go." But she did. On the morning of April 10th, I thought that perhaps I should have to put off the start once again, but she, as she got out of bed, said to me, "I feel that you will start this morning. Go and get ready. I will come and say goodbye to you at Ciampino." I waited for her. The airship was on the field. I trembled at the thought of seeing her arrive with her eyes swollen by weeping. It would be very difficult to take leave of her in those conditions. But instead, at the very last moment, she came forward to say goodbye, tranquil, serene, almost smiling. She kissed me gently, murmuring, "Go away happy," and those fond, sweet words echoed in my mind at every moment during the flight. When, at the end of the expedition, after 3 days of silence, the wireless brought news that we had arrived safe and sound in Alaska, dissipating the anxiety of Italians throughout the world, since they could not get hold of me up there in the peace of a tiny Eskimo village, many people made a great fuss of my wife. It was the best way they could have found of thanking me. The telegram from the Queen of Italy to Maria, the roses Mussolini sent to my wife, were the most precious gifts I could have had. Our little girl Maria was then 8.5 years old, the happy age of almost perfect ignorance. She hadn't the faintest idea what the pole might be. When she heard that Papa was going to make this voyage, she made me show her the journey on a map, put one small finger on the Spitsbergen Islands, and said, "There, there's nothing in that, you'll get there in a moment." Then, even she, after she had heard the grown-ups talking, began to get worried. On the morning I left, when I hugged her to me, she was very quiet and pale. The flight from Rome to the Svalbard. The start from Rome. We started from Rome then on April 10th, a Saturday morning. I reached the Ciampino airfield about 7 o'clock. Everything was ready. The latest weather reports, drawn up that morning, although not excellent, were passable, but we would run into high winds over France. I decided to go. Having tested the engines and loaded the provisions and the luggage of the last arrivals, at 9 o'clock I gave the order to bring the airship out of the hangar. Nobody had been told about the start, except Thomason and the secretary of the Norwegian legation, Van Gesten. Both were there. Van Gesten. On the field, there were engineers and workmen from the factory of aeronautical constructions, all those who had shared my years of work and struggle, and who had helped me to prepare the expedition. I was waiting impatiently for my wife and child. At last they came. At 9:30 a.m. I went on board. 2 minutes later, I gave the starting signal. Let go! Freed from the pull of the men who were hanging onto the ropes, the airship rose slowly, solemnly, amid the clamor of farewells and good wishes. From the control cabin, our tricolor flag fluttered bravely. I had the engines speeded up. The spring sun was shining from a clear blue sky. After flying over the city, I turned seawards. At dusk, we reached the coast of France. The U.S. Navy command was always, "Up ship," which may have been derived from the German Schiff hoch. I knew someone in high school who said, "I don't know how anyone speaks German without a spittoon." I will not linger over the details of that marvelous flight along the Canal du Midi in the starlit darkness. A violent wind was blowing, sometimes reaching 36 miles per hour. It was in our favor, but later over the north of France it changed direction and became a headwind, reducing our speed to a few miles an hour, so I had to force the engines, bringing our airspeed up to 58 miles per hour. Nevertheless, we took 4.5 hours to cover the 102 miles between Angers and Rochefort. At dawn, when the sun rose, the squalls increased to the point of producing a pitch and roll that became truly alarming each time when, in the hope of finding calmer weather, I tried to fly closer to the ground. We struggled on in these conditions for hours and hours, right up to Courcelle on the Channel coast and across the Channel to England. At last, northeast of London, the wind began to drop. At 3:20 in the afternoon, when we arrived at Pulham, conditions were much better. We landed at 5:50 after very difficult maneuvering. On landing at Pulham, we found the Crown Prince of Norway and Sir Samuel Hoare, the Minister for Air, waiting for us. But the only one who was not pleased about that stop in Pulham was my dog Titina, and with good reason, since she had no sooner arrived than the English shut her up in one of the storehouses of the hangar, requiring me to promise that no attempt would be made to set her free. But next morning one of the Italians went to say hello to her and found that the poor animal, in her efforts to free herself, had torn her collar, and that she was so upset at being separated from us that she had not even touched her food. Moved to pity, he let her out, and Titina, crazy with joy, came rushing up to me while I was giving orders in the hangar to prepare our departure. But her happiness was short-lived. She slipped away out of the hangar into the field. We called to her and brought her back at once, but too late, she had already been seen. Shortly afterwards, a gentleman in uniform called on me, tall and impressive, the police chief at Pullum. "Kindly keep the dog shut up. If she is found outside, we are entitled to kill her, and there is also a 200-pound fine." So Titina went back to prison, and although the English, to make her confinement more bearable, petted her, gave her sweets and a new collar, she cried all the time. Ah, yes, the English pet quarantine is still in effect, by the way. It's 8 weeks or something that you, if you bring a pet dog or cat into England, or into Britain, it has to be kept in a quarantine kennel for something like 8 weeks. Having completed our various formalities, the customs official stamped our logbook. Cleared inward, HM Airship Station, Pullum, Norfolk, April 11th, 1926. Aside from their unkindness to Titina, the English treated us most courteously. I found several old acquaintances at Pullum, officers who had come to Rome a few years before to take delivery of an airship that we had built for the English Air Force. Glad to see me, they put themselves at my disposal for anything we might need. Meanwhile, on the morning after our arrival, I had ordered Cecchioni to fill up with petrol and gas and to check the engines. I wanted to be ready to leave next day, April 13th. That afternoon I consulted the meteorologists. The prospects of continuing our voyage seemed fair. Only one expert was doubtful, on account of a deep depression coming up from the Atlantic. It seemed to me that conditions might even justify trying to push on directly from Oslo to Spitsbergen without stopping in Russia. Therefore, I telegraphed to our chief technician Rossi, who was at Vadsø, and to the Aero Club of Norway, to know whether the two stations at Vadsø and Kings Bay were ready to receive us. The reply was in the negative. Work on the two mooring masts and the hangar would not be finished before the end of April. However, I decided to take advantage of the fine weather to go on at once to Russia, where we would wait until Vadsø and Kings Bay were ready. Our departure was fixed for the evening of the 13th. At 10 o'clock, after the last customs formalities having been quickly completed, I gave the necessary orders. An hour later, we cast off. From Pullum to Gatschina. There were 20 men on board, all those who had started from Rome, except Scott, Mercier, the meteorologist Heredia, and Marconi's rigger Huggins, who had disembarked. In exchange, we had taken on Captain Paunessa, Cesco Tomaselli, and the Norwegian naval attaché in London, who had asked me if he might fly with us as far as Oslo. I love that thought. It's like, oh yeah, there's an airship going, I'll just take that. What? So we had four passengers, this officer and the three journalists, Ram, Quattrini, and Tomaselli. The route which I had arranged to follow, Pullum, Oslo, Stockholm, Helsinki, Leningrad, was not difficult, but I had not reckoned with the fog, which caused considerable deviations. On the first leg, Pullum, Oslo, everything went well, although the fog below us cut off our view of the sea. We arrived in Oslo at 11:30 a.m. Greenwich time, having covered 705 miles at an average speed of 57 miles per hour. The Norwegians gave us a joyful welcome. Aeroplanes came to meet us. The whole city appeared en fete. Thousands of people had gathered in the squares, in the streets, on the roofs of buildings. The king himself had come to the foot of the mooring mast. Bright sunlight illuminated the magnificent spectacle. In the afternoon, after the meteorological service had warned me that the weather was breaking up, I left the airship and went with Thomason to the Grand Hotel, where I had a meeting with the meteorologists, who unanimously advised me to leave Oslo that very evening as quickly as I could. The depression was advancing towards Norway. The weather was getting worse. Already the sky was overcast. I returned to the foot of the mast and made arrangements to leave. Around midnight I started the maneuver. Yes, as far as I know, the N1 was the only airship that Norway has ever flagged. Below us by the mast, the Italians carried out my orders in the darkness, broken only here and there by the scanty light of projectors. He means searchlights, I think. In the distance, around the fence that protected the mast, a crowd of spectators from time to time shouted joyful farewells whilst I gave the last orders. Unhook! And the Italian officer on the summit of the mast, obeying the order, set in motion the unhooking device. The airship was now only held by a solid hemp rope. Slip the rope, and the rope was slowly paid out, so that the nose of the ship very gradually slid away from the masthead. I checked the equilibrium. Everything was in order. As soon as the rope had been cut away, the airship would rise with no shock and at the right angle. Cut! The word rang into the darkness, and freed from the tie, the Norge rose, illuminated by the shafts of light, up into the darkness. A rapid turn to the pointers controlling the engine switchboards. The swish of the propellers told me that the order had been received and executed. Still climbing, the airship gathered speed. It says engine switchboards. I'm thinking engine telegraph is the English term for this thing. Soon we found ourselves immersed in the thick fog which covered the hills of Oslo and the fjord. Rapidly we rose above it, while I ordered Horgan, who was at the rudder, to steer southwards over the sea. We had left Oslo at 1:08 on the morning of April 15th in the dead of night. For many hours the fog was so thick that we crossed the Scandinavian peninsula and the Baltic without recognizing a single place. When at last, at dawn, the fog began to thin out, we found ourselves over land, countless small lakes, one beside each other. This is a characteristic Finnish landscape, but there are also chains of little lakes in Estonia and Latvia. The radiogoniometer and a solar observation taken by Reiser Larsen showed that we were in Finland, but we could not rely on our radiogoniometer, and as for the height of the sun, when Horgan repeated the measurement, it gave him a latitude half a degree further south. I ordered Reiser Larsen to scrutinize the ground and see if he could find any indication that would enable us to recognize where we were. Soon afterwards, he said that, from the color of a postbox and the direction in which a half-frozen stream was flowing, he was sure that we were in Finland, but it is easy to be mistaken. In fact, when I looked down, I had the impression that the current was flowing in the opposite direction. To increase our doubts, Gottfald came to tell me that he was hearing the wireless station at Reval loud and clear, as if it were quite close. So our uncertainty continued until it became exasperating. To put an end to it, I gave orders to steer southwards. The reasoning which suggested this detour was simple. If it was true, as Reiser Larsen maintained, that we were in Finland, by flying south we should soon come to the sea. If, on the other hand, after flying for an hour or two, we had not seen the sea, that would mean that we were on the other shore of the Baltic. The sea did not appear. Now and again the great dark forests on the horizon gave an illusion of it, but as we approached them we discovered our mistake. At last we found a farmstead lost in the wide colorless plain. A group of peasants stared up at us. I had the idea of questioning them. I prepared a message. What country is this? Finland? If so, raise your arms in the air. I had it translated into Swedish, which most Finns understand, Russian, and German, and threw it down. The astonished peasants, gazing at the airship that was circling over their heads, did not notice the message, and nobody picked it up. We went on flying south, following the railway, which we had come across a while previously. At last we saw a town. I called the Russian Olomkin. From the shape of a church, he said that he was sure we were in Russia, but I wanted to know the name of the town. I decided to lose height and circle around the station until we could read its notice board. The experiment succeeded. We were at Valga, on the railway line from Riga to Reval, on the borders of Estonia and Lithuania. It was 3:27 p.m. This is a great example of that old aerial navigation technique known as IFR, I Follow Railways. With the wind behind us, we covered the 200 miles between Valga and Gatchina at an average speed of 70 miles per hour. This rapid flight over the snow-covered, wooded Russian plain, vast, empty, and so solemn in the sunset, and our arrival at Gatchina are among my most vivid and beautiful memories of the journey. Dusk had already fallen when we arrived at the airfield, yet the whiteness of the snow illuminated it, throwing into strong relief the monk-like figures of the hooded Russian soldiers in their long yellowish overcoats. As is customary, they were arranged in wedge formation, in two rows converging at the point, to receive us. It was 6:16 p.m. Central European Time. We had covered 738 miles in 17 hours. I made a brief circuit of the field, and at 6:50 we came down on the snow. Old acquaintances and friends, who had been waiting there for us since the morning, greeted us with cries of joy. Bombieri, our consul at Leningrad, our naval attaché, the agent for foreign affairs, Weinstein, General Zinoviev, Professor Vorobiev, Professor Pochivetsky, Pozhichevsky, Professor Pozhichevsky, doyen of the Road and Railways Institute, and many others. Transliterating Russian into Italian is no joke. The hangar was in darkness on account of an unexpected breakdown, and the Russians carried out the maneuver silently and efficiently by the light of the snow and of a few portable lamps that we had on board. A few minutes later, the Norge was safe in the hangar after a flight lasting 43 hours. I was exhausted. For 60 hours, I had been awake without closing my eyes for a moment. Good training indeed for the polar flight. Tired as I was happy to have accomplished this second stage towards the north. We had arrived in Russia on April 15th, the exact date which I had given the Russian authorities 4 months earlier. I could hardly stand. They put me into a sledge and took me to the Imperial Palace, where I was a guest of the Russian government. An hour later, in one of the salons of the palace, I could barely summon up strength to murmur a few words of thanks in reply to the addresses of welcome from the agent for foreign affairs and the doyen of the professors. Immediately afterwards, I dropped into bed in the room which they had assigned to me, the very room in which Kerensky had slept many years previously. Kerensky, the head of the ill-fated provisional government. Our welcome in Russia. In Russia, we received a very friendly welcome. The Soviet government kept its word, repairing the hangar at its own expense and equipping it with all the necessary services, supplies, workshops, ground crew, and watchmen. The organization had been carried out regardless of expense, with a lavish quantity of personnel and materials. The sight of the people who every day hastened out to Salitsy to visit the airship was very picturesque. Troops of schoolchildren accompanied by their teachers, pupils from the various military institutions, university students, officials, engineers, workmen, peasants, men and women of all ages and types came daily in their thousands, crowding round the doors of the enclosure around the hangar. They were really interested. They asked questions. They wanted to see our flag. In many simple, affectionate ways, they showed their admiration. These demonstrations from total strangers moved me. In the train between Leningrad and Gatchina, in the street, in the hangar while we were working, everywhere people looked at us with a friendly respect. Especially around us Italians, there had arisen an atmosphere of goodwill which warmed our hearts, making this long and nerve-wracking wait in a foreign land far more bearable. Flowers from the Imperial Park. One day, coming back from the hangar at Salitsy, I found on the table of my splendid room in the Imperial Palace a tiny vase with some pretty little mauve flowers and a message. Vera Makarov offers you the first flowers from the park. I had no idea who Vera Makarov might be, but later I learned that she was the wife of the director of the Imperial Palace, the superintendent of the museum. On my arrival at Gatchina, Makarov had told me, "Make yourself at home here. We want to do everything possible to make you comfortable." And in fact, they spoiled me. As soon as the flowers faded, they were renewed, and I was surprised to find on my table a collection of Italian books, beautifully bound. For hours and hours I remained alone, no one venturing to disturb me. Only from time to time an old servant entered to ask if I wanted anything, if I would like some tea, a little woman with a wrinkled face, but with such sweet eyes and affectionate, almost maternal manners. She took care of Titina, chatting away to her at length in her incomprehensible language. Towards the end, I fell ill and had to stay in bed for a day or two. How wretched it was to be so far from home without any of my dear ones near me! The good woman understood, and came to my room trying to guess my needs, find out in advance what I wanted, since we could not understand each other. One evening, when I was more than ever depressed by my solitude, she guessed how far my thoughts had strayed, and with a gesture full of kindness, she took up my little girl's photo from the chest of drawers and looked at it affectionately. To be so moved by the kind action of an old Russian peasant woman, one must know, as I did, that I should not see my dear ones for months, perhaps for years, perhaps never again. As our departure approached, these good people did even more for me. With a piece of old carpet from the palace, they made me a pair of warm boots that I used from Leningrad all the way to Teller. They packed food for the journey, not only essentials, but a number of delicacies, which my companions consumed with great relish during our flight over the Barents Sea. The night before we left, I think the Makarovs hardly slept. Next morning, they were at Salitsy to say goodbye, and with them came the old servant to caress Titina for the last time. So you've been listening to Hear Now the Words, or something like it, on Anon Radio, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. If you'd like to support these broadcasts, patreon.com/Publius_reads for a recurring contribution, paypal.me /Prometheus Lives for a one-time one, but most of all, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth,